Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Never wish away a minute of your life. You want this to be over, right? When can this end? When can life go back to normal? We've said this a million times to ourselves, not just during the pandemic, but countless times in ordinary circumstances. When we were excited for Christmas to come already, when we waited for a friend who called ahead to say that they'd be late, while we were listening to that boring lecture. In his book, Travels with Epicurus, the writer Daniel Klein recalls a formative moment. I remember one long ago evening, he said, on an overcrowded train to Philadelphia, hearing a young woman moan to her mother, "God, I wish we were there already." Her white-haired mother replied eloquently, "Darling, never wish away a minute of your life." Remember what Seneca, Epicurus's rival and secret fan, would say, "Life isn't short, we just waste it. We waste it wishing for things to be otherwise. We waste it waiting for it to be over. We waste it by ignoring what's in front of us. We waste it by resenting, complaining, rejecting. Now is now. Can never be anything else. Now is your life. Live it. Love it. That's all you can do. You won't get anything else. You won't get another moment. Never wish away a minute of your life. It's a gift, should you choose to accept it." To me, this is what that exercise of memento mori is about. It's why I carry that memento mori coin in my pocket. I've got it sitting on my desktop as well. Memento mori, you can leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think. You can check that out in the Daily Stoic store. We have a necklace and a signet ring as well, and a poster. You can check that out in the Daily Stoic store. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. I feel like at the core of Stoicism is this pursuit of rationality. The Stoics believe that our rational mind was the mind we were aspiring to live by. That's why the Stoics talk about logic. This is why the Stoics talk about really taking a minute, taking your impressions, putting them up to the test, thinking through them, not just reacting emotionally, instinctively, reactively. And in fact, when people think of the Stoics as being emotionless, I don't think that's it at all. I think what the Stoics tried to do was not
make decisions or take actions based on the heat of an emotion. So a Stoic might get angry, but their rational mind allows them to think through in that space between the stimulus and response, as Viktor Frankl talks about, to not take action based on their temper. That almost never gets you the outcome that you want. In fact, Athenodorus recommends this to the Emperor Augustus. He says, look, before you get angry, you should repeat all the letters of the alphabet to yourself. And he's saying this, and Seneca's writing about it later in his book on anger, because angry rulers, looking at the evidence, we see rarely make for good rulers. So at the core of Stoicism is this idea of rationality. And that's why today's guest, the one and only Steven Pinker, and his new book, Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems So Scarce, and Why It Matters, is someone I very much wanted to talk to. This new book is great. I read it. I really enjoyed it. We talk about that in the interview. We also talk about his book, The Language Instinct, his book, The Blank Slate, and most famously and most provocatively and more recent, his book, Better Angels, is about the decline of violence and the progress we've made as a species. Look, I love the Stoics. I love writing about the Stoics. I would not have wanted to live in Marcus Aurelius's Rome. As I've talked about COVID before, COVID's very serious. I'd much rather live today when we have the remedies to deal with COVID than in Marcus Aurelius's time when they were lighting incense, hoping to keep away the Antonine Plague. So we have a really fascinating conversation, and Steven Pinker is the top of the top as far as his field goes. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, one of Time's most 100 influential people in the world, Foreign Policy's 100 Global Thinkers, sold a bazillion books. He manages to take really complicated, difficult, even one might say boring topics and make them not just accessible, but fascinating. And I think does so in a way that allows you to apply it to your actual life. So I was so excited and honored to talk to the one and only Steven Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard, music lover. We nerd out about the band a little bit towards the end. Anyways, here is my interview with Steven Pinker talking philosophy, rationality, self-improvement, and the progress of the human species. So I love this this Guardian profile of you.
I could have left it, but anyway, I was not. It was not a good use of 3 days of my time.
Why not?
Well, he presented a lot of things totally chopped out of context. Snooped around my apartment, my office, around my private memorabilia, and then kind of presented it as if I was some kind of narcissist for displaying it. I didn't know, it was kind of none of his business in the first place. And they were kind of snooped around for any dirt that he could find. And I know from a number of former students that he contacted that they spoke to him at length, and none of that made it into the interview. So it was an adversarial profile. Ah. I knew that was possible because 25 years ago, I had read Janet Malcolm's famous essay on how journalists like to cozy up to their subjects and pretend to be friends, but then often write highly compromising articles. So I was prepared for. I mean, a lot of people like you. I don't know if you were being sarcastic or not, but a lot of people said, "Oh, great profile! You came off so well." And perhaps that is the impression I'm being overly sensitive.
No, I actually did think it was largely positive. But isn't it interesting when you are the subject of how the news is made? And then I think was the Gale amnesia effect. You see how the news is made when it pertains to you or something you're an expert about. And then you go back to consuming the news as if it wasn't made with a similarly misleading or fundamentally flawed process, right? Like speaking of rationality, if our understanding of the world is dependent on the news media, and then you just experienced how the news media works, it does shake your understanding of the world a little bit.
Yeah, it does, and there is a kind of insight that you get from being a subject of a of a media profile. And I remember the first time I was in a documentary many years ago, it gave me a new appreciation for how films are made. Just seeing it through different eyes, knowing how the process works. And it was a good experience, because even dramas and fiction, just knowing how the cuts must be selected from a much larger recording process, what choices a director makes, gives you a new set of eyes with which to view the whole medium.
Yeah, that's one interesting argument I've heard for why public trust in the media is at an all-time low. Now that effectively we are all content creators of some kind, everyone sort of understands how these algorithms work to a certain degree, or understands the incentives that are operating under content creators, because we've experienced it in our own Facebook feeds or Twitter feeds. We the illusion of the sacredness of the media, or its sort of flawless methodologies, has fallen away, and that's partly why we don't trust the media as much.
That could be. Although I suspect the bigger factor is the polarization that.
Sure.
Everyone hates the media that they think are giving unfair coverage to the people they hate.
Yeah, you have an interesting study in this book where you show, was I think it's gun control, and then sort of the presuppositions you bring to it determines how you read that data.
Well, it's an example of the my side bias, which is. Yeah. One of the most pervasive of all of the cognitive biases. It affects people regardless of their intelligence. It affects people on both sides of the political spectrum. But yes, in the clearest illustrations are that if you present a policy proposal and you say it comes from a Democrat, then the Democrats think it's a great idea, the Republicans think it's stupid, and vice versa. Or if you present the results from a study that tests some policy intervention favored by the left or right, each side will think that the data support the position that they believed all along, even with the same data. And sometimes even more so if they are highly numerate, it does not protect them from interpreting data in the way that they prefer a priori.
Yeah, and I want to talk about all that. I don't want to spend too much time on the media, but it did strike me that if rationality is always hard, and I think it always has been hard, it's got to be more difficult in a time where, and you quote Steve Bannon, flooding the zone with shit. It's got to be harder to be rational when the zone is flooded with shit, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, sort of whoever you are, whatever you're trying to study. Having to wade through misinformation and disinformation and just plainly lots of information, it makes a sort of a timeless struggle more difficult, I suspect.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's exacerbated by the huge amount of editorializing supporting your own point of view.
Right.
That you can get that that dubious form of pleasure or satisfaction from seeing the umpteenth article that attacks your enemies or ratifies the justness of your side. And we have not all of it is fake news, but a lot of it is all too much fun to read and can reinforce people in their prejudices.
Yeah, and maybe the solution to the problem is just everyone should consume a lot less contemporaneous information. I mean, there's something about a 300 or 400 page book, or in some of your books are much, much longer than that. If I remember The Blank Slate, yes. and Better Angels. But I think there is something more conducive to rationality when you are reading a long form sort of analog argument, as opposed to reading a thing that's been reduced down to 240 characters or 1,000 words that you're reading on your phone as you're being besieged by ads, or, there's a rabbit hole you could go down at any time. I think we need sort of quiet, dedicated space to explore big ideas. Like if we have these cognitive biases, we need room to sort of override them, so to speak, and perhaps the sort of technology and the medium with which most people get their information is not conducive to that.
Yeah, there is that, but trade it off against the fact that there is so much information available, so much bad information, but so much good information, even for sure. A discerning consumer of editorials, of reporting, of explanatory articles in the sciences. I sometimes find myself despairing at the lack of time to read all the things that clearly are high quality and interest me. So it's a kind of a perverse byproduct of one beneficial aspect of the internet, namely that there just is so much interesting stuff around. And so the shorter articles and the ones now with the actual reading time posted at the top of the article, you address the problem. There are only so many hours in the day, and there's some optimal trade-off between breadth and depth. But you're right, there's some arguments that can only be pursued at book length. I obviously believe that, otherwise I wouldn't write these books.
No, they're not fun. They're not fun to do.
They're not fun to do. I hope they're fun to read, to consume. And certainly what I have avoided, even though I do have a Twitter account, it's got more followers than I thought would be possible, but I avoid the style of Twitter commentary of just issuing a snarky pronouncement on all of the events and other articles that cross your screen. I use it as a... I virtually always will link to some article that expresses the argument in adequate depth and length. So I consider my tweets to be like the taglines published under the headline of a magazine article. This is what this is about. This is why you might be interested in reading it. But the substance of what I'm trying to communicate is contained in the longer article. And not always a book, but a long enough article that it isn't the 240 characters.
But I feel like even some of the instances where some of the things you've said have been controversial, but then anyone that publishes on the internet and says like, here, look, here's all the evidence for what I believe, you sort of get people go, I've seen enough. I saw the headline. I have my opinion formed already. And I'm like, I get this with my books. I wrote a book a few years ago called Ego is the Enemy. Not the Freudian ego, but the sort of the colloquial ego. And people, I'll get emails, people go, well, I haven't read your book, but here's why you're wrong.
Yes.
And so you're like, is there anything more egotistical than knowing that I'm wrong before you have read it? But that's what people do. We have our instantaneous reaction to things and we go, that's enough.
True enough. And there is an art form of Twitter snark and sarcasm, where you have a pithy comment that usually snide, that puts down or dismisses or demonizes some other commentator.
Sure.
And it's that style that probably doesn't lead to enlightenment.
Well, I've always felt like the straw man, the sort of Twitter response to Better Angels was an odd one, because you have this, it's a beautiful book, it's very long, but there's this sort of straw man that what you're saying is that humanity is just getting better and therefore we don't have to do anything, that progress is sort of preordained, and or people will try to go, well, what about this bad thing? How does that fit into your argument? But I always felt that what your argument was in that book was that the reason things are better is that a lot of hard work and effort and changes has gone into making them better. And that while we are the heirs to that tradition, it could also stop at any moment as well.
That's exactly right. And I continue to be amazed at those two responses, both of which seem to be really elementary blunders of thinking, but that are surprisingly complex. The one is, well, how can you say things are declined? Bad stuff happens. Well, yeah, but those are totally compatible. Namely, bad stuff happens, but in the past, even more bad stuff happened. That is, it's the a decline is not the same as a disappearance. To say that X is less than Y is not the same as saying that X is zero.
Right.
So there's that strange inability to even conceptualize the concept of progress. Namely, things can get better without being perfect. And the other one that you correctly identified, which is surprisingly commonplace, is things got better. Oh, so you're saying they got better by themselves. Well, no, that doesn't follow. Things can get better not because they got better by themselves, but because people tried to make them better and occasionally succeeded. And the implication being, if we want things to get better still, we should figure out what worked in the past so we can do more of it now.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorn sponsored today's episode. Thorn takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorn, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorn. Go to thorn.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorn.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Yeah, and you obviously talk a lot specifically about violence and reduction and the sort of changes we made as a society that did that. What I thought was really interesting about the new book, Rationality, is, and I didn't quite feel that till I got towards the end, and you say it explicitly, but you could almost argue that this book is a prequel to Better Angels, because you're sort of making the argument that of all of the things that have produced the progress and thus the decrease in violence, rationality was the first thing, that almost all of these movements or changes began with some sort of either rational breakthrough, a rational discovery, or a rational argument like, hey, no human should own another human. That's wrong. That really rationality is necessary, but not sufficient for progress of the human species.
Yeah, and it was a surprise in writing Better Angels how often a moral movement, a movement toward greater social justice, at least temporally originated with an argument for something that today we would think needs no argument. Like, right, you really have to argue why you shouldn't burn heretics at the stake. And the answer is people did. And then those arguments came. It's harder to prove that they were causal in the sense that if no one had actually written that viral pamphlet, the progress would have been delayed by another century. But it's not implausible given the chain of events. It doesn't mean that every improvement was conceptualized and argued for. In the Better Angels, I talked about, for example, the decline of tribal raiding and feuding and blood feuds, the decline of medieval brigandage and homicide and deaths from jousting and other conflicts among medieval knights, some of which may have been a byproduct of the consolidation of kingdoms and states, where, I mean, there was some thought that went into it, namely, it's a nuisance for emperors and kings if their subjects are fighting each other, just as it's, you know, a nuisance for farmers if his livestock fight each other. He doesn't care. He doesn't care what their argument is about, and it's just a dead loss for him. But the fact that it did benefit the peasants if they stopped killing each other as much, it wasn't what was in the mind of the kings and emperors, but it was a somewhat happy byproduct. But those are, I mean, that can happen. That is, that beneficial historical trends can be not undesigned or unintended consequences of other motives. But many of the ones that we're proudest of, that we think of as genuine moral progress, did not just begin with people spontaneously assembling and pushing for for greater justice. It did originate with someone formulating the argument.
Well, it's sort of like all cliches were probably an original quote at some point, right? Somebody came up with that phrasing. And oftentimes, you know, you can trace a certain cliche back to some person. It's, you know, it's always, you joke about Albert Einstein. It's always Albert Einstein or Mark Twain or someone.
Occasionally Yogi Berra or Groucho Marx, yes.
Yeah. But it's like somebody said it at some point, meaning like somebody had the idea. But that also makes me think, you know, of this idea of the great man of history theory, the idea that like somebody, again, made the argument at some point, right? So Thomas Jefferson makes the argument that we're all created equal. He puts it in a document and it does fundamentally change the direction of humanity. It's not a totally original thought, but he manages to phrase it and support the argument as such that it convinces other people to go along with it. And that's rational, the ability to rationally do that. Maybe we understate the importance of that.
That's right. And Jefferson is an excellent example because, of course, he himself was a flawed man, to put it mildly.
Yes.
And the country did not live according to his principles. That was precisely, almost to the word, what Martin Luther King in his famous speech after the March on Washington, namely, this country issued a check. It was so far it's a bad check. We're here to cash it.
Yes.
Namely, that all men are created equal thing. Remember that? You promised we're here to hold your feet to the fire to force you to make good on it. So the idea outlived the original implementation. It was there to appeal to, and it did have an effect. I think, by the way, the general influence of arguments on history, not so much as great man, but I think it was who said, was it Victor Hugo? There's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come.
Yes.
And it isn't, I mean, in the case of Jefferson, of course, there is that statue of him in Washington, and he's on the $10 bill. Now, is he on our currency?
He is. I forget.
The point is,
I haven't seen cash in so long. I forget.
Yeah, true. Right. Anyway, he's, you know, everyone knows who Thomas Jefferson is. But the thing is, it wasn't about him. It was about the idea. And there are movements where the idea having been loosed in the intellectual marketplace of ideas, people may not remember who originally formulated the idea, takes on a life of its own. And in the case of feminism, for example, I cite the first English feminist, Mary Astell, who, co-opting one of John Locke's arguments for why we shouldn't have slavery or absolute monarchy, she said, well, geez, if there's a good argument against slavery in the country, why should there be slavery in the home? If it's not good for a man to be under the arbitrary whim of a king, why is it okay for a woman to be under the arbitrary whim of her husband or father? And you know, the idea did catch on, but we don't call it Astellism, and right. We don't, you know, kind of march around with posters of Mary Astell. It's kind of, I don't want to say it's irrelevant that she made it. She deserves enormous credit. But what counts is not that, you know, this particular woman said it, but that it was a good idea. Someone had to have said it. She was the one.
Yeah, it's almost as if, like, in the way that obviously someone invents the hammer or the wheel or some yes. early man invents a tool, and then that tool, history is people applying that tool in different contexts to solve different problems or building on it or tweaking on it. these ideas are almost like the building blocks of our collective progress. And someone's saying, hey, you know, you shouldn't be able to do this to white people. Hey, you shouldn't be able to do this to Black people either. Hey, you actually shouldn't be able to do this to people at all, you know, men or women. You shouldn't be able to do it to people in different countries. And we're sort of, it's like we're constantly applying or extrapolating out the, I don't know what the word is, but the telos of the tool into different contexts and getting different results out of it.
That's exactly right. The philosopher Peter Singer called it the expanding circle back in a book in the late 70s, Defending Sociobiology. Of course, the next logical step is, well, why stop at Homo sapiens? Other animals are sentient too, and many of the arguments that we make against torture and slavery for other races should be extended to other species. That is, there is a kind of self-expansion, I call it moral dark energy, in the notion of respecting interests of sentient beings, that all of the lines that separate sentient beings into categories are at least morally arbitrary.
Are there any ideas like that or expand, like if we're thinking about the moral progress we've had versus where is this energy going in the future? Are there areas or ideas or things that you see, I don't want to say as promising, but just almost less judgmental? Where do you see the areas that we're expanding into, or where do you see the forward progress potentially going?
The idea behind effective altruism, namely that we try to measure the effects of our interventions and do the ones and keep the ones that actually do the most good, save the most lives.
Sure.
Is a promising idea. And it is a relatively new idea. Like, you know, go out and measure and see if what you're doing actually benefits the people you want to.
And ranking it in comparison to other interventions, like that this charity has an ROI of X and this charity has an ROI of Y. And yeah.
Exactly. And taking into account things that people often forget, such as if there is a newsworthy story featuring some pathetic and highly photogenic victims. Sure. It, of course, it's good to help them. But remember that the very fact that it was in the news means that lots of people are rushing to help that little girl or this sure. particular community. And it may be that so many people have seen the news and have been motivated to hit the donate button that it's kind of the aid organization may have been saturated and you might be better off donating to some movement that does not get the same publicity on a particular day, but
sure.
is saving lives 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. No one of those days of which makes it into the papers, but the dollar would be helping, saving far more lives. So that's another new idea about beneficence and philanthropy. And another would be to try to explicitly take into account our own biases in order to work around them. The identifiable victim effect being one of them, namely we are probably too affected by the photogenic victim in terms of which may subvert the greater goal of helping as many people as possible, but also our vulnerability to the availability bias, that which is that we estimate probability by how easily examples come to mind. The news feeds the availability bias because that's kind of what it is. It's an availability machine. And it may be that solutions to big problems, including climate change, including safety and terrorism, might be hidden from us because we glom too easily onto a gory image from the headlines that morning, as opposed to the underlying reality as revealed in data.
Yeah, I'm, I know it's not exactly new, and I know it's sort of a boogeyman for some people, so it kind of becomes almost fundamentally irrational, the response. But it also strikes me that some of the reckoning or conversation we're having with what they're calling critical race theory, again, I think it's a relatively bad name, but the idea that there are interlocking or interrelated forms of oppression or injustice, that just one's intent on a given action is not the whole story, that that there could be legacies of issues or sort of different again, structural or systemic issues. So that again, the thing might have started with good intentions, but the outcome is fundamentally unjust because it doesn't address for preceding inputs. That strikes me as a relatively innovative or new way of thinking about injustice and progress. I'd be curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I tend to have a more critical view of critical race theory and critical theory in general. The problem with the movement is that by seeking to demonize, that is, trying to root out racism, a highly loaded and emotional and condemnatory term for what might be unplanned outcomes, it can easily turn into a hunt for villains instead of an attempt to understand cause and effect. And it may also misapply energy for reform to rooting out ever more subtle forms of racist, because it really, by using the term racism for any kind of racial discrepancy, it's a movement that basically attempts to demonize. Who are the bad guys? They may not realize they're bad, but we should all condemn them. Whereas some of the discrepancies might be the unplanned results of social and historical forces, where there isn't a bad guy now. There may have been bad guys 250 years ago or 100 years ago, but kind of doing this moral reckoning may not be the way to achieve real equality and to reduce poverty and crime and incarceration for vulnerable minorities like African Americans. There's a saying that I quoted in the Better Angels of Our Nature from the great pacifist statistician Lewis Fry Richardson, who responded to the cliche, "To understand is to forgive," and he said, "Well, you know, maybe, maybe not, but to condemn too much is to understand too little. If what you're always doing is trying to root out racists to shame, you may be oblivious to what is really happening, and therefore point to the wrong causes, and therefore be impotent in actually trying to improve the lives of the people that you're hoping to benefit."
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Yeah, it's a tricky thing, because I think it's sort of political execution has been counterproductive at best, sloppy or outright flawed at worst. But the idea of, to sort of go to what you're saying, that to me it strikes me as a kernel of value in the idea that there could be injustice without a bad guy, right? Like that strikes me as an insight as far as how we understand history, how we understand systems, how we understand moving, what we should try to do or build going forward. The idea that a racist is not always a bad boogeyman, but that there could be racist ideas or structures or systems in place that no one would choose, but because they are legacies of other things, we have them. that strikes me as an idea of as having some value.
I think the idea, I agree, the idea absolutely has value. Although to call it racist, which is a condemnatory term, it's a vile thing to be a racist, but to identify policies, structures, laws that disadvantage African Americans as racist means that you are saying that there's a bad guy. And in practice, sure, that's exactly what's happened. People get canceled, right, even for discussing the tenets of critical race theory. If you disagree with this dogma, that makes you a racist. Now, a racist is a vile thing to be.
Right.
The fact that these accusations are being leveled, I think, rather recklessly, not only is unfair to its targets, who may be legitimately disagreeing with some dogma. But of course, as we know, history has taught it, that leads to a reaction, such as the election of Donald Trump, from people who are saying, well, I'm sick and tired of being called a racist. I'm not a racist, and I'm not going to vote for a party that keeps demonizing me, that calls me a deplorable.
Well, no, I think as a linguist, the idea that the language with which you describe the idea is so powerful and has an impact on whether it will be successful or not. It's like you could contrast Black Lives Matter, which is effectively a perfect political slogan because there is no argument. Like, even the All Lives Matter argument sort of puts you in a trap. Contrast that with, say, the defund the police argument. The language that a group decides to use, or the way it decides to communicate an idea. Again, critical race theory doesn't sound, even if it's not being blown up on Fox News with bad faith, it still doesn't sound something like something you'd want to subject your children to. It just sounds bad. It's ominous and scary at worst, unexciting and boring at best. The language with which we use to describe these ideas, I guess that says we're irrational, that the language matters, but the language does matter.
It does. And, I think a year or 18 months ago, no one would have had any associations to critical race theory. It's some, that's some highfalutin academic idea. Why should we care?
Right.
But people, have correctly, at least approximately correctly, known that there is some very new approach and idea, often being forced on them in schools and workplaces, involving collective guilt, involving deliberate segregation by race. And they needed a name for it. To say that critical race theory is this abstruse academic doctrine only debated in graduate seminars, it strikes me as a little disingenuous, because these are distinctive and radical ideas. They do historically and intellectually originate from critical race theory. Obviously, once they're implemented, they're not going to reproduce all of the abstruse theoretical foundations, but you need to call it something, and that's kind of what it is. In the case of defund the police, it's another case in which there I think it's kind of different, because you don't have to be in the know to and have it explained to you. Perhaps quite the opposite. There the explanation is, defund the police doesn't mean defund the police.
Right.
Oh, great. Thanks. First, get the slogan out there. Which, of course, nearly cost the Democrats the election. This is an election that everyone thought was going to be a blowout. It almost went the other way. And there are some, we don't know for sure, but there's some pretty good data that fears about defunding the police and similar policies scared a number of people on the fence into not voting for Biden unjustly, because he himself, of course, did not support that policy.
Sure. So in the way that we can have these kind of positive feedback loops with an idea being then spread through society, does it, and that seems to be the cycle that we've been on for about, 2000 years, we sort of have been, the rationality and enlightenment has been taking us in a positive direction, largely because of the sort of extrapolations of the ideas that we're talking about, whether it's free speech or freedom of association or freedom of religion or equal rights or any of these inventions. And they were inventions, although obviously some people think they come to us from God, but somebody decided that was what God wanted and communicated it. Do you think it's equally possible to get in a negative feedback loop? Like could sort of anti-enlightenment values something like, I don't know, I don't want to put too much on critical race theory, but let's say you get a different set of ideas and then those begin to extrapolate. And let's say they're fundamentally irrational or fundamentally anti-progress. Could it go the other direction?
Oh, you bet. And it has. The heyday of Marxism in the middle decades of the 20th century, Marxism originated, it was highly theoretical. That's why intellectuals loved it. You could debate it in graduate seminars and probe what Marx really meant, the young Marx and the old Marx and all the different offshoots of Marxism and different versions and Gramsci and the way it was incorporated into critical theory and postmodernism, kind of all too intellectually rich.
Sure.
But it did pull people into a rabbit hole, and it led to horrific consequences. One sign of any, you might take a step back. There are people who say, well, rationality is totally overrated. Yeah, you got the Enlightenment, but then you also have fascism, which had its theoreticians. You also have communism. Now, here's what I think is a crucial difference. It would take a good historian to establish this firmly, but I suspect that any movement that kills its critics or fires or shuts them up, that's probably a sign that this is a decadent intellectual movement that's not going to lead to something good. And right. The thing about at least the strands of the Enlightenment that I would be prepared to celebrate is that they developed in liberal democracies. They did have freedom of the press and free speech and open criticism and debate. So that if some idea was disastrous, then someone could say so without being sent to the gulag or shot in the back of the neck or canceled. And that when you have a movement that says you may not criticize it, it is evil to criticize this set of ideas, that's when you know it's vulnerable to getting locked into error because no one can point out the error.
Sure. And people are afraid to even come close to pointing out the error because
exactly yeah. Right. Yeah.
So how does that work then in tension with something that you talk about in rationality, which is that sort of rationality is a public good, that our sort of rational system is a public good? And what do you do then when you have, and my first book was about sort of media manipulation, and I was looking quite heavily at the sort of the turn of the 19th century and the early 20th century when you have the yellow press. A lot of people were writing, and Upton Sinclair did it most interestingly, yes. that in the same way that the trusts were sort of poisoning our food supply with industrialization, so too was the media sort of poisoning our sort of public sphere. What is your thought today when, yeah, rationality is important, these Enlightenment values are important, but then we are held hostage effectively by anti-rational movements who are poisoning that sphere, whether it's the social media networks that enable it, or it's the anti-vaxxer, the people who are, I don't even want to say acting in bad faith, because you talk about Pizzagate in the book. I'm not sure they're operating on a level where they know that this is wrong, and you're just dealing with the consequences of toxic irrationality, effectively.
Yes, and indeed, and you're right that some of them aren't acting in bad faith, and that they sincerely believe the nonsense and the harmful ideas that they're propagating. It's not that they're kind of cynical manipulators,
right?
But rather that they're all too firmly entrenched in their beliefs. Yeah, there's no easy solution, because on the one hand, we want only kind of correct and beneficial ideas out there.
Right.
On the other hand, none of us is an angel who's capable of always knowing which ideas are correct and which ones are beneficial.
Right.
Which is why we need as the cliche has it, a marketplace of ideas, why we need freedom of the press and free speech, so that when there are flaws, someone else can point them out. How do you prevent the emergence of an idea that's popular and wrong, or popular and harmful?
Yeah.
Part of the answer is you have the opening, the ability, the freedom to point out what's wrong with ideas. You try to spread a culture of critical thinking, not to be confused with critical theory, open-mindedness, of evidence-oriented mindset, set of values, like when the facts change, I change my mind, you know, what do you do? Media literacy in school, how not to believe something just because you saw it on the internet, or for that matter, read it in the mainstream media too, because they sometimes get things wrong. What are the tools that will allow you at the end of the day to evaluate ideas? Now, what I've said is this is what we should aim for. We, in a democracy, we really don't have a guaranteed way of making sure that the popular idea is the correct idea. We probably never will, absolutely, but sure, at least steer it in that direction. I think part of the answer, to be at least a little less vague, is that, and this is an argument that has been advanced by Jonathan Rauch in his book, The Constitution of Knowledge, in which I make in somewhat different words, which is that, you know, what cognitive psychology has told us, and which many of astute observers of human nature have noted before that, is we are all subject to fallacies and biases, particularly favoring the sacred beliefs of our own coalition and demonizing the others. You know, on the other hand, we have done better. Science really is better than superstition. Liberal democracy really is better than hereditary monarchy. How do we do it, despite the fact that we're made out of crooked timber? Well, we have institutions that are explicitly committed to moving us in the direction of the truth, and that have mechanisms and rules and norms that push us in that direction. And examples being, say, scientific societies that have peer review and open criticism and empirical testing, liberal democracy with its freedom of the press and political debate, government agencies that are committed to accurate record keeping and that themselves check for error, responsible journalism. You talked about yellow journalism, which you have written about. But of course, some would say we still live in an era of yellow journalism. But it's probably, I think you'd agree, it's
much better.
It's better. Yeah, it's better. Why is it better? And Rauch talks about that as a journalist himself. Well, the journalistic institutions around the 1920s kind of realized they got to get their house in order. There's too much what we today call fake news. I mean, sort of credulous stories about, you know, sea monsters and two-headed babies. And
they police themselves effectively.
They police themselves, exactly. Yeah. And they instituted codes of ethics, and newspapers had hierarchies of editing and fact-checking to try to weed out all of these errors that, left to our own devices, we make them, all of us. And so it's the institution that is our hope. And these are institutions that have to have certain mechanisms, certain, first of all, overarching commitments. They have to be designed with the goal we should aim for objective truth. Granted, none of us ever has it. None of us ever knows that we have it, but let's strive for it. And here are ways that we can capitalize on the fact that people, even if they're irrational themselves, they're not so bad at pointing out the irrationalities of other people's beliefs. Let's capitalize on that kind of adversarial nature to have, you know, adversarial proceedings in court system, peer review in science. As James Madison put it in the design of the American Constitution with its checks and balances, let's let ambition counter ambition. So these are the kind of mechanisms that are our best hope for attaining rationality, given that none of us by ourselves can do it.
No, I think that's very well said. And it goes to your point, like, somebody obviously created those institutions at some point, right? So those are, you know, forms of progress. But it made me think about the role of institutions. I was at a dinner. I may have told this story on the podcast before, but I was at a dinner with a Trump cabinet official and a bunch of Republicans a few months ago. People I happen to disagree with, but I like spending time with people I disagree with. And You know, they were talking about the very real concerns about Facebook banning the president of the United States. And they said, you know, I don't know if you want these private institutions banning your politicians. And I was like, look, I agree. There are real concerns here. This is not a great precedent. But the reason that Facebook, a private, you know, digital company, had to do that is because you and your party at every step of the way failed to do your institutional duty, right? Like the point of political parties at the state level, at the national level, the point of conventions, the point of all of these groups is that at some point along the line, you would have hoped that one of them would have said, this is insane. This person is not at all remotely qualified or to be trusted with nuclear weapons. And you didn't do that. And that's why eventually, coming out of an insurrection, Facebook had to ban this person. And so I think your point that institutions, while not firmly governmental, do have an obligation to protect this common good. And perhaps the tragedy of our rational commons is that those institutions have not been doing their job.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, but it does then raise the issue of who gets to decide on what criteria that, say, sure, the institution of a particular political party has failed, and therefore we must step in. Because sure, you wouldn't want to open the door, say, to if Facebook or Twitter leaned right and someone said, well, we're going to ban Joe Biden, and the problem is that you Democrats didn't do your job in preventing this dangerous villain Joe Biden from attaining the presidency. So I think the way I would put it, I mean, it doesn't contradict what you said, but it might kind of address the problem of, you know, who decides in what way, how do you prevent these platforms from not themselves becoming political weapons? Is in the case of Trump, what they did point to, and what they should point to even more strongly, is not that, you know, Trump is a menace and he's an evil stooge or whatever, but rather we do have a line that we can't cross on our platform, namely advocating the violent overthrow of the government or advocating violence in general.
Sure.
So he crossed that line. He happened to be a Republican. If a Democrat crossed that line, we would do the same thing. This is one of the perhaps legitimate carve-outs for restricting speech. And indeed, First Amendment jurisprudence recognizes certain circumscribed areas, and advocating violence, particularly if it's advocating violence to overthrow a democratic government, could be one of those zones where we don't want to police speech, but there's certain places you can't go, or at least you can't go on our platform.
Right. Well, the irony, though, of the democratic institutions, although the democratic arm certainly has extremists, you know, you look at the 20 or whatever candidates that ran in 2020, and the institutions actually did select until the most moderate of all of those candidates was ultimately sort of put to the fore. And so it strikes me as, one of the problems of the Democratic Party right now is that at the highest level, it's moderate, but then at the lower levels, it's less moderate. And the inability to bridge this gap is why they can't pass legislation. But the purpose to me of these institutions, and maybe it's the point of also grammar and manners and all the things you talk about in your books, it's to moderate these, what the ancients would have called passions of the human species and of the human mind.
Quite so, exactly. And I guess one could argue that all the complicated, clanky, Rube Goldberg and corruptible primary process resulted in something that, you know, is not bad, an outcome. And in democratic governance, not bad is pretty good. Because as John Mueller, a political scientist that has influenced me a lot, wrote a book called, a sadly obscure book called Democracy, Capitalism, and Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery. The allusion being to the Prairie Home Companion, the town of Lake Wobegon, with a grocery store whose motto was, if you can't get, it was called Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, and its motto was, if you can't get it here, you probably don't need it. And what Mueller argued is that democracy, and he also argued about capitalism, has these horrible flaws, but it's kind of pretty good, especially compared to the alternatives.
Yes.
And so if we have an outcome in governance, you know, run by human beings with all their flaws, that's, you know, kind of pretty good, not bad, okay, could be worse. That might be the best that we could humanly hope for. And that when we seek something that's perfect, then we're liable to become totalitarians.
Yeah. And if you look at COVID, it's like we did really bad in some areas and really good in other areas. And it kind of washed out to, like, I don't want to say middle of the pack, but if we had been more in a, if the government or if, the, if we'd been more enabled in certain areas, the bad things might have been worse. And if we had less power in other areas, it, the outcomes might also have been worse. So it's kind of like, what was the Churchill line about how it's the least bad system?
It's the worst form of government, except for all the others yeah. that have been tried. Yeah. In the case of COVID, I mean, you know, the question is, how do we kind of assess how we're doing to know what our reform should be? In the case of COVID, certainly comparing rates across states, across countries, evaluating you know, as openly as possible, well, what did work in the end and what didn't, given that at the outset, we were kind of ignorant about everything. We tried various things. Let's go to the data and see what worked better than others. And in the case of the United States, I think the case can be made. It was not bad. It was bad in the sense that we can look at other countries and see that they did better.
No, I just mean, like, you could argue the sort of containment of the virus, we did the worst of the development world, of the developed world. And then as far as addressing and then preventing it's sort of the prevention of the virus or containment of the virus pre-vaccine, post-vaccine, and then of course now the logistics of executing the vaccine. But certain Indeed, things yeah. we did better than average and other things we did much worse than average. Yeah.
Well, developing, rolling out the vaccines, we did pretty well, but then of course, well, we know what's happened since.
Yes. Irrationality inserts itself.
Indeed it does. And a number of things went wrong. I mean, it really should have been under control by now. But
well, that's so one of my favorite quotes from Marcus Aurelius, who was also writing during the Antonine Plague. He says there's sort of two types of plagues. There's the one that can take your life, which, as we understand, he probably did die of the Antonine Plague. But he's like, the worst one is the one that destroys your character. That sort of affects you as a person. And it does strike me when you look at, you know, some of these people that say things on the internet or some of these, the videos are sufficient. You go, oh, this person caught something else. It's not COVID, but it's worse.
Yes. Well, and my friend, philosopher Andrew Norman wrote a book called, I think, Mental Immunity, where he pushes very hard the analogy between virulent pathogens and virulent ideas and a well-functioning biological, physiological immune system and a kind of cognitive immune system.
So two last questions to bring us back to where we started about the Guardian piece. You noted something that I have found in my own experiences, which is that my books have sold disproportionately well in the UK also. Oh, why is that? Are they just more philosophical over there, or is it a different media culture, a different bookstore culture? What do you think it is?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't know whether it's more word friendly, literate, intellectual culture where you get, you know, perhaps because of one beneficial byproduct of a class system that had a lot of downsides, sure. Is that there a certain prestige did accrue to being, you know, articulate, knowledgeable. It could be, or it could be more geographical. I mean, London is the equivalent of New York, Boston, LA, Bay Area, all rolled into one, namely
right.
that the politicians, the finance people, the academics, the literary intellectuals, sure. all kind of rub shoulders. They go to the same parties. Whereas in the United States, we've got, you know, finance in New York, entertainment in Hollywood, academia in Boston, and so on.
And it's not just that those are different cities, but they're geographically hundreds or thousands of miles apart. And so they each have their own media market as well. So I've just found that the UK is a bit more old school. It's like you're more famous in the UK than you are in the US, even if you've sold fewer books, because media is so much more concentrated and there's less competition.
Interesting. And there are still, I think, because of the BBC, media channels that I don't want to say everyone, but that a lot of people listen to. So everyone, well, I don't, again, not everyone, but lots of people tune in to start the week and to, you know, night news. And there's a still a more concentrated media landscape than what happened in the United States.
It might be what the U.S. market was like 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Last thing. So you're a fan of the band?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. And your fellow Canadians, four to five of them. Yes.
So by modern standards, this is my trick question, said facetiously, but by modern standards, isn't the night they drove Old Dixie down an act of cultural appropriation?
It sure is. It's actually got pretty, you know, dopey lyrics if you actually listen to them. If the bells were ringing, people were
what
singing.
What bells? Yes.
During a military defeat. I mean, like a lot of rock songs, you don't want to look at the lyrics too carefully because they make no sense.
Yeah.
It is. And, you know, culture is appropriation. I mean, all of culture is a pastiche, a greatest hits collection. The insular, provincial, parochial parts of the world don't develop great culture because it's the same old stuff, concentrated and recycled. Great art always picks and chooses from the best of the cultural tradition. It kind of sits at the confluence, catchment area of a huge number of ideas and motifs and themes. And the band is actually a great example because they were so eclectic. They played so many instruments. They were influenced by so many genres of music. Appropriated left, right, and center.
You know? I love that as an example because it's like, if I told you a Canadian band, and I think the lead singer is an Indigenous person, right? Or he's I'm forgetting his name, but
Robbie Robertson.
Yeah.
Robbie Robertson. He is. Well, that may be a good example. He was the main songwriter and the ringleader to the band. He was part Indigenous. He was part Jewish. He was part Anglo-Saxon, and you know that didn't hurt.
Right. No.
And of course, these Canadians were celebrating the great tradition of rural American music, none of which they, except for Levon Helm, they experienced themselves. They grew up in rural Ontario or urban Ontario. What did they know about, the Dixie music of the Dixie?
No. And that's what it's like. So you have this Canadian, potentially Indigenous guy writing a song about the fall of the American South in the Civil War. That doesn't piss people off the way that, a white person rapping or a Black person doing loving kung fu or something. It doesn't piss us off because it's not actually the cultural appropriation is not offensive. It's actually a key artistic form of progress. And it's almost always done. I would say when it's done well, it's just called art. And when it's done bad, it's called bad art. Right. And we would be lost without it.
I couldn't agree more. That's a beautifully put.
Well, then we'll wrap up there. Stephen, thank you so much. I've loved your books for a very long time, and this one is very good. And I do hope we can continue to preserve. I hope we can do a better job preserving our rational commons as we have with our environmental commons and natural resources, because it's all we have left.
Thanks so much, Ryan. A great discussion. Very deep and probing. I enjoyed speaking with you.
It was an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible
interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He asks real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.